Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, seeking signs of hope as the death toll climbs and President Trump removes a key watchdog. We talk with Bill Gates about how he sees a way out of this pandemic.
The vaccine is critical because until you have that, things aren't really going to be normal. They can open up to some degree, but the risk of a rebound will be there until we have very broad vaccination.
Then a call to action, from struggles for supplies to a higher death rate among people of color. The governor of Maryland and the mayor of Chicago on leading at a local level. Plus, we hear from emergency medical technicians what they have seen from the ambulances as they race to save lives. And politics in the pandemic to Wisconsin, where voters are heading to the ballot box today, despite warnings that polling places are a hot spot waiting to happen. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The coronavirus pandemic has claimed well over 80,000 lives as of tonight, including more than 12,000 in the United States. And New York City has surpassed its own record of deaths set by the worst terror attack on American soil. Still, there are new signs of hope. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
Another grim milestone reached.
A lot of pain again today. For many New Yorkers,
deaths in New York City have now exceeded 3,200, more than died in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. But the number of new patients being ferried to hospitals is dropping, and Governor Andrew Cuomo says that is a sign of progress.
Right now, we're projecting that we are reaching a plateau in the total number of hospitalizations, and you can see the growth, and you see it starting to flatten.
Other states are also seeing early signs of containment. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy urges staying the course.
But we cannot be happy with only reaching a plateau. We need to keep strong and keep determined to see that curve begin to fall and ultimately get to zero. That's going to require many more weeks at the least of our being smart and staying at least at all times 6 feet apart.
But in Wisconsin today, staying 6 feet apart presented a new challenge for voters. The state Supreme Court ordered the primary to take place as scheduled after an 11th-hour legal battle to delay in-person voting. Lines outside polling stations stretched for blocks. National Guard troops stepped in to run sites where poll workers failed to show in fear of catching the virus. Meanwhile, the pandemic's effect on detained migrants came into sharper focus. Amnesty International reported that detention facilities have failed to adopt adequate measures to prevent outbreaks. The report says they're not ensuring basic hygiene and sanitation or enforcing social distancing practices and quarantining people with symptoms. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has reported 19 migrants have so far tested positive as authorities continue to detain individuals and families. Advocates have asked ICE to provide alternatives to detention. The agency announced today it may start doing so for certain detainees, including those over 60 and pregnant women. But the Trump administration's efforts to control the virus have been called into question even outside close quarters like these. The New York Times reported today that warnings about the scale of the crisis circulated around the White House in late January, even as President Trump publicly downplayed the threat. Memos from trade advisor Peter Navarro warned the virus could take millions of lives and cost the economy trillions. President Trump also came under fire today for replacing Glenn Fine, the independent watchdog who had been chosen by peers to oversee the rollout of more than $2 trillion in coronavirus relief funds. And in Britain today, Londoners woke up to news Prime Minister Boris Johnson had been moved to intensive care overnight, battling worsening coronavirus symptoms.
It is quite worrying for the country, for people in general, because what's going to happen? He's the leader, right, of the country. It is quite worrying.
Officials said Johnson relied on oxygen support, but without the need of a ventilator and with no signs of pneumonia. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab, now at the helm, said Johnson's diagnosis came as a shock.
He's not just the Prime Minister. For all of us in Cabinet, he's not just our boss. He's also a colleague and he's also our friend. And I'm confident he'll pull through. Because if there's one thing I know about this Prime Minister, he's a fighter.
And in Wuhan, China, the original epicenter of this crisis, upbeat residents flocked to the streets, ready for an 11-week lockdown coming to an end. China reported its first day since January with no new deaths. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Here in the U.S., Wall Street rallied for much of the day on hope that the pandemic is easing. But oil prices fell sharply and the rally died. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 26 points to close at 22,653. The NASDAQ fell 26 points and the S&P 500 slipped 4. At a time when everyone is looking to understand the scope of the pandemic and how to minimize the threat, one of the best informed voices is that of businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates. The co-founder of Microsoft has spent the last few decades focused through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on improving global health, including reducing the spread of infectious diseases. We spoke earlier this evening. Bill Gates, thank you very much for joining us. You were one of the prescient few years ago who said that an infectious disease outbreak was coming that could kill millions of people. How is what is happening now different from what you expected?
Well, sadly, I would say that the economic damage is much greater. I put $3 trillion for a respiratory virus spreading around the globe, and you know, clearly we're going to go well beyond that. You know, the whole goal of speaking out then wasn't to be able to say, I told you so when it happened. Rather, it was to make sure that we did the right thing so that diagnostics would come out right away, the timeline for a vaccine would be very short. And sadly, not many of those things were done. So we're now scrambling to come up with therapeutics, scrambling to try and figure out how to get this vaccine made. But you know, people are rising to the occasion, but it's a very bad situation.
Well, speaking of things that weren't done, testing. This has become one of the central problems facing the United States right now. President Trump said, I think, 3 weeks ago that there would be some sort of rapid testing. He mentioned Google. He said that was imminent. It hasn't happened. Why is this so hard? And what do you think it's going to take to get a rapid turnaround test in place?
Yeah, we need a variety of tests. The testing that's currently being done, which is a PCR-based test, there was an advance that our foundation drove that now you can do a self-swab, so you could very quickly do the test without having the healthcare worker have to wear protective equipment and having to change that. So eventually we'll have a home test that you can just swab and send back in for the PCR.
So what is the most immediate thing that needs to be done with regard to testing?
Well, you can imagine having a website where you enter in the criteria of your symptoms, are you an essential worker, where you are, and it gives you back a priority level. And so all the testing operations make sure that they're only taking in enough high priority stuff that they can maintain a very quick turnaround so you don't have stale results. You know, that should be reasonable to put together. In parallel, we've got to go as fast as we can on therapeutics and go as fast as we can on a vaccine, because therapeutics can save a lot of lives and avoid the overload. And with luck, some of those will be promising in the next 3 to 6 months. The vaccine is critical because until you have that, things aren't really going to be normal. They can open up to some degree, but the risk of a rebound will be there until we have very broad vaccination.
Well, and you've said it may take, according to the scientists you work with and you talk to all the time, it could take up to a year and a half to get that vaccine. What are you saying literally that it could be the fall of 2021 before Americans can be safe from this COVID-19?
Before you can be completely safe. I mean, by doing the strong social distancing that most of the country's engaged with right now, that allows you to level off the cases and bring it down. And you want to bring it down to a level that your capacity to test, to do contact tracing, to make sure the quarantine's maintained, so you don't see a big rebound, even though you've allowed most work to continue, you know, school, you know, certainly in the fall, you'd like to see that go in. You know, so we want to have that period, have the economy not as damaged as it is in this extreme period where we're, the numbers are so big and they've been growing exponentially that we've got to get that down so that it's much lower.
But when you talk about returning to some semblance of normal, what are we saying that looks like? I mean, you mentioned keeping up social distancing. What could life look like, say, 6 months, a year from now? There's still some of these steps we're taking now, they would remain in effect?
Yeah, I'm working to write about that. The closest model today is you look at China. They are sending people back to work, but they're wearing masks, they're checking temperatures, they're not doing large sporting events. And so they've been able to avoid a large rebound. There are countries like Sweden that aren't locking down quite as much and seeing, okay, do their numbers go up? If so, can you trace back which are the activities that are causing that? We need to learn from all the countries. Our partner, International Health Metrics and Evaluation, is looking at forecasts where they compare the different countries. And then, you know, that's helping us to understand, okay, which policies in which countries seem to be working. And so we'll be far closer to normal once we get that those case numbers down. But there will be some things where the benefit to the risk, like large public gatherings, may not resume until broad vaccination has taken place.
Meaning conventions, when you say large public gatherings, over 10 people.
Yeah, well, we'll have to figure out how to draw that threshold. And we may even understand age-specific risk at that point. And so having a classroom with 30 young people in it may be just fine because their role in transmitting the disease, you know, we'll understand in the next month or so. It may be so limited that you're far more liberal with young people getting together than you would be with a general age audience.
A couple of questions about the economy. The Wall Street firm Evercore is projecting a 50%, that is 50% drop in GDP this quarter, an unemployment rate of 20%, twice as high as during the financial crisis. They're projecting another 5% drop in the third quarter. And that's before we begin to come back. Is that your assessment?
Well, again, I'm not as deep an expert on that as I am on vaccines. If you had just a three-month period of extreme shutdown, and then you were able to do a large degree of opening up, that, you know, in the end, is the best thing from a medical point of view and an economic point of view. One thing that'll be very tricky, though, is when we open up, you know, people's psyche in terms of their wealth and their willingness to go out and do things has been deeply affected. So even once you fix the supply side by allowing people to go back to work, factories to run, then you'll still have a huge question about the demand side, you know, taking trips, buying new houses, you know, even buying a car. This is very unprecedented. And so although that model you mentioned looks like one of the more negative, it, you know, the uncertainty is such that it's not out of the realm of possibility.
The continent of Africa is a place that you and your wife Melinda know very well through your foundation. You've done so much work there. How much do you worry about the effect of this pandemic in a place like that when it hits there?
Yeah, sadly, it seems likely at this point that even though the deaths in the developing world have been very small as yet, because not that many people with the disease went there as moved around in between rich countries, that because their health systems are so limited, because The social distancing is much harder to do where you live in a slum right next to each other. You have to go out to get your food. There isn't the capacity to run the food distribution system with just a small percentage of the workforce like the U.S. has. And so trying to help those countries get their testing capacity up, figure out what tactics work for them that may be different. The kind of social distancing rich countries do may not work. And so how do you tune that? Sadly, you know, I do think that most of the deaths will be in those countries and the most extreme economic pain. You know, they're not able to borrow, you know, 10, 20% of GDP, which many of the rich countries are engaged in that exercise. They just don't have the credit worthiness, you know, the sense that that'll drive hyperinflation would be very strong. So even though it's super important that we deal with the domestic numbers and get those down, as we think about innovation, as we think about the rest of this year, the suffering in those countries, we also need to be thinking about that and help as much as we can.
Did I hear you say you think most of the deaths will come
in developing countries? Yeah.
And finally, a personal question. You certainly know this issue better than most anybody else, and yet it has shaken a lot of people. It has caused people who are normally, you know, together in their lives to be quite rattled. How do you think you've been affected by this?
Well, I'm deeply shaken. You know, every day I'm like, are we really in this situation? Wow. You know, there are things like polio eradication that, you know, we're making progress on that. This is going to be an unbelievable setback for that. You know, people are taking the resources that are funded for that and shifting them to this priority. So, you know, who knows where we'll be on those other efforts. You know, we have some great HIV breakthrough drugs that we want to get out into trials. Those trials aren't happening. In fact, you know, the top people who were going to work on that have been reassigned to work on the coronavirus vaccine. So, you know, the foundation is scrambling because it has a lot of the key understandings and relationships to accelerate some of these solutions. But our normal work, you know, is suffering. And, you know, you just look at people who are isolated at home or, you know, overcrowded in their home or kids who are going to lose 3 months of learning. The amount of pain involved in this thing is gigantic. And, you know, so it's deeply troubling, but we need to still act to minimize all of that.
Well, Bill Gates, we thank you very much for spending the time with us, for talking with us today. Thank you, and we wish you and what you're doing at the foundation the very best.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, acting U.S. Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modley resigned after a tirade against the captain of a warship that has been hit by the coronavirus. Modley had fired Captain Brett Crozier of the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt for sending out an email plea to evacuate his crew. Then on Sunday, the secretary addressed the crew in Guam and lambasted Crozier.
It was my opinion that if he didn't think that information was going to get out into the public in this information age that we live in, then he was A, too naive or too stupid to be the commanding officer of a ship like this.
Modley apologized last night for those comments, but calls for his ouster mounted. President Trump said this evening that he had no role in the resignation and would not have asked Modley to leave. He also designated James McPherson as the new acting Navy Secretary. He had become Undersecretary of the Army just last month. White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham is leaving that position after 9 months. At President Trump's direction, she never held a formal press briefing. She will now become the First Lady's Chief of Staff, as well as continue her role as Mrs. Trump's press secretary. The new White House press secretary will be Kayleigh McEnany, who is now spokeswoman for the Trump reelection campaign. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has broken off talks with the Afghan government. The group says that negotiations on a prisoner exchange have gone nowhere. The U.S. reached a troop withdrawal agreement with the militants in February. It's supposed to be a first step toward a broader settlement. Australia's top court today threw out the criminal convictions against Roman Catholic Cardinal George Pell for sexually abusing children. The judges found there was reasonable doubt about his guilt. Pell was released after 13 months behind bars and driven to a monastery in Melbourne as abuse survivor groups condemned the decision.
You just feel really sad because the emotions are just so vast, really, and there's so much to think about and to take on in all this.
Pell had been the most senior Catholic Church official to be jailed in the long-running abuse scandal. The University of Michigan is sending letters to nearly 6,800 former student athletes in a sexual abuse investigation. The school wants them to speak to investigators about allegations that go back to the 1960s. Former campus Dr. Robert Anderson is accused of molesting students for decades. He died in 2008. A federal appeals court allowed Texas today to limit most abortions during the coronavirus pandemic. State officials have classified abortions as non-urgent procedures during the crisis. A lower court blocked the policy last week, but the appeals panel ruled that the state is protecting the public health. The ruling is likely to be appealed. A black pioneer in magazine publishing has passed away. Earl Graves Sr. died on Monday after battling Alzheimer's disease. In 1970, he launched Black Enterprise. It was the first magazine about black entrepreneurs to be owned by an African American, and he used it to champion black business. Earl Graves was 85 years old. And a so-called supermoon will light up the sky tonight over much of the country. The moon will be full and closer than usual, less than 220,000 miles from Earth. That should make it the brightest and the largest lunar show of the year. We need it. Still to come on the NewsHour, speaking with the governor of Maryland on how his state is coping with the crisis. Front lines, what emergency medical technicians have seen in the fight against coronavirus. The mayor of Chicago on why black Americans are being hit hardest by the pandemic and what can be done to address it. Plus, COVID-19 and the campaign, Wisconsin voters head to the polls.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As hospitals in coronavirus hotspots brace for difficult weeks ahead, governors across the country are working together to ensure frontline medical workers get the critical protective gear. Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan is the chairman of the National Governors Association, and he joins us now from Annapolis. Governor Hogan, welcome back to the NewsHour. Your state of Maryland, we believe, has now passed 4,300 cases, surpassed 100 deaths. In any way, do you feel you're getting your arms around this?
Well, it's very hard to ever feel like you're getting your arms around it. I mean, I feel like we're as prepared as we possibly could be. You know, I was one of the first in the country to declare a state of emergency, and we've taken unprecedented actions every single day for the past 33 days. But like everyone, we're trying to play catch up and try to stay one step ahead of it. But it's a very difficult crisis for anybody to say that, you know, we've got our arms wrapped around it.
What do you most need right now? As you know, so much conversation about governors having a hard time getting the equipment, getting the supplies they need. What is the most critical to you now?
Well, it's the same for every governor, I think, Judy. It's the same thing that you keep hearing about. And it's the most difficult thing, I would say, right now is ventilators. And we were successful in getting a couple of hundred ventilators from the administration, a commitment of 200 more ventilators. That's what New York is being faced with right now. It's just, but it's PPE. It's all the protective equipment that we need for our hospitals and our healthcare workers. It's testing and testing kits. And that's just something that all of us are dealing with. We're searching for these things all over the domestic market, all over the world, and we're asking our federal partners for their help as well. But no governor sitting by just waiting for these things to arrive. Everybody's working very hard to try to ramp up these availabilities.
Well, as you know, governors are speaking out and saying they're having to not only compete against each other, they're competing with the federal government, with FEMA, they're competing with other countries. Is that just the way it's going to be for the duration of this pandemic, or is there a fix in sight?
I think it's improving, Judy, to tell you the truth. I mean, look, it's not a perfect situation, but it's getting better rather than worse, I would say. We're having ongoing discussions, all the governors with the administration. There are new laboratories that are ramping up with new tests and more availability of tests. We're certainly playing catch up. It's not where we need to be, but I think we're better off today than we were last week, and we're catching up. But it's certainly not where anyone needs to be today. But it's a lot better than it was, and we've got more testing going on in our state, and I think in most states than we did last week.
Just moments ago at the briefing at the White House, President Trump told reporters, he said, among other things, he said, if your governor is failing to get you what you need, he said, I'll protect you. I mean, is that the way it now works?
Well, look, I think what we really need right now, the real enemy here is the virus. That's the common enemy we're all fighting, and it's going to take the federal, state, and local governments all working together to try to fight this common enemy. And we don't need finger pointing from anywhere. I don't think there are any governors failing anywhere in America. I can tell you, as somebody who's been leading discussions with the governors on an ongoing basis, and many of them with the president and vice president, and many of them with just the governors, I'm really proud of the job that they're doing. And I don't think we need finger pointing about any governors failing. I think every governor's doing the best job they can. And I think the federal government's doing their best job to help us. But we ought to just do a lot more figuring out how to fix these problems rather than, finger pointing from any direction.
Governor, you announced today the first in the nation, I believe, their so-called strike teams to go into nursing homes in Maryland. Tell us how that works.
Well, so this is a problem across the country. You remember the first crisis happened in the state of Washington with this nursing home that we all were shocked to hear about. And now we've got 90 nursing homes here in our state where we have at least one case, but it's several of them with really dramatic outbreaks. A number of other states do. We are sending in strike teams with members of the National Guard, with doctors and nurses from our local health departments and from local and regional hospitals to go in on an emergency basis to try to wrap our arms around this and to identify the situation, to triage the situation and send people when they need to hospitals or to take care of the situation right there with both testing to find out, exactly where that facility is and what help they need, because this is our most vulnerable population. We're having these outbreaks across the country. So we took actions about a month ago to limit visitors and to make sure we're checking staff members. But still, we've got these outbreaks, and we've got to make sure we stop them before they become widespread. And the strike teams are just one new tool that we're unleashing today.
And just quickly, finally, I read that you also announced that the state is going to start reporting or launching what they call a coronavirus rumor control page on your website. Is that because of so much bad information being out there?
I think there's just a lot of people that are just relying on a lot of like random rumors that they pick up on social media, and it just runs rampant. So we're just going to try to, I think facts are really important, and that's why we've tried to be as transparent as possible, have the doctors and the experts talking. And so we want to separate fact from fiction. I think at a time like this, it's particularly important that people are hearing from the scientists and the doctors and not running rampant with things that just aren't true.
Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, thank you very much. And again, we wish you the very best in dealing with all this.
Thank you, Judy.
New York does remain the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. Doctors, nurses, and medical teams who are in that state are bearing the brunt of a surge of seriously ill patients. William Brangham recently spoke with two who are on the front line about their work.
Adam Blyden is an EMT, an emergency medical technician in Rockland County, about 25 miles outside New York. Same with Pierce Matthews. They both drive ambulances, responding to 911 calls across the county. Like so many places in New York right now, coronavirus has become all-consuming. I spoke to the two of them the other day. As a percentage of the calls you're getting now, how many would you assume are coronavirus cases?
100%.
100%?
100%. Yes. The rarity of getting a regular emergency, which sounds crazy, a regular emergency where someone needs our help right away and we can do something, in 10 calls, you may have one. So it's almost 100% are either confirmed cases or suspected cases.
That has got to be, I don't know, want to put words in your mouth, but nerve-wracking. Like, if every person you possibly interact with, sometimes very, very close, if you're worried that person has coronavirus, that's got to be, mentally exhausting.
It is. That coupled with the call volume going up drastically, in most cases, more than doubling your call volume every day. So a shift that you might see, 8 patients on, you're getting called to 16 to 20 different houses. We're going from 100 calls a week to 200 to 250. It's intense. It's really intense.
It's scary, and I would say a better word to use is terrifying, especially when you don't believe you have the correct PPE to use. And it's scary. We're scared just as much as the regular person, But we have to do this job. We signed up for this. This is what we do for a living. And, EMS personnel and hospital personnel are proud to do it. But it's very scary. It's not that they're very infectious. That is obviously the case, that COVID is an infectious disease. But it's also that the people that we're seeing may not live. And as EMS and healthcare workers, we're used to trying to do our best to save lives. So it's emotionally taxing, I think, on the healthcare personnel.
Last week, me specifically, there were at least 3 patients who I had seen earlier in the week who I came back to work a couple of days later and found out they had passed away. I was just there. How quickly, was that that she went from being alive to not alive anymore, or he went alive to not being alive.
That's got to make the statistics that we see, these numbers and cases going up every day, we see them as bar charts, but for you guys, it seems obviously a lot more visceral.
Yeah, it's not a chart, it's not a graph, it's a person who you saw, who you touched, who you spoke to, and now they're not. Now they're, sadly, they've gone on to become a statistic. That's one of the harder parts of this, for sure.
Last night, I got off at 2 a.m. I went to a friend's house to evaluate his father, who is bedridden, who was diagnosed with pneumonia. I cried from the station to his house and in front of his house for probably about 2 additional minutes. Because I during my shift, I worked for 24 hours straight. I couldn't really... I couldn't really have emotions because I was working. We have to do our job. We all have to do our job. We signed up for this. This is what we have to do. We have to, treat these patients and make sure everything is okay and, treat the community. And, after the end of my shift, I broke down. I cried, just thinking about everything that I had to see, the patients that I knew probably would not make it.
On top of that, we have the fear. Have I been exposed? Am I going to give it to someone else? All of us, you ask anyone in emergency services, we're all immortal. You can't kill us. And now it's getting closer to home that we need to start considering our own health as well. I think yesterday we lost, they were retired guys, but there were 2 firefighters who passed away yesterday from this. Those are guys who gave their whole life to their fire departments. So it's getting closer and closer to home for all of us. It's no longer, if we're going to be exposed, that's gone. We're all going to be exposed. we don't know when.
On top of the stresses of the job, of worrying whether they themselves might get sick, many EMTs also have to work for low pay and few benefits.
The average salary for an EMT in New York State, doing what we're doing through all of this, is about $37,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, right now, both Pierce and I, everyone who's doing what we're doing, we're juggling, usually it's two or three jobs just to keep working so we can pay our bills. We do this because we love it. Everyone knows there's no money in it. But right now, I'm doing all of this with no health insurance.
No health insurance?
No health insurance.
How is that possible? It doesn't come through the job.
The job doesn't offer it, and our affordable marketplaces aren't very affordable. If I get sick and, okay, I go get tested positive, I can't go to the hospital. Literally life or death is what's going to put me in the hospital. It's scary. And, you know, people come out and they show us the support, and I love it. I've eaten so much pizza in the last 2 weeks. It's been great. I don't need pizza. I need to be able to pay my bills. I need to be able to work a 40-hour work week and live like a normal human being.
I know you guys have probably seen all these videos of people clapping out when there's a hospital shift rotating out. And I mean, I hope you know that there is, everybody out there does on some level appreciate how crucial you all are to keeping all of us safe.
I appreciate you saying that. And it's tremendous support, and we need it because it's not easy. It's really not easy. You know, we're scared also. The general public is scared about this virus, and we are too, but we also know that this is our job, and you know, we love to do this. You know, this is something that you have to have passion for, you know, helping people and on the medical side, you know, just making sure, you know, fixing people and making sure they're okay is something that we like to do. We love to do it. So it makes us feel really good when we feel the support from the regular people and also from other agencies like police and fire. I appreciate that a lot.
The pandemic hitting the U.S. is hitting people of color especially hard, according to early data. The CDC has not published breakdowns of deaths by race, but some places are disclosing that, and the numbers are alarming. In Michigan, roughly 40% of deaths were among African Americans last week. In Louisiana, almost 70% of deaths were, and that was true in Chicago as well. As part of our Race Matters series, Yamiche Alcindor takes a closer look at what's happening.
The trends are particularly bad in Chicago. That city's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, joins me now. Thanks so much for being here, Mayor Lightfoot. In Chicago, some 70% of the people who have died from the coronavirus are African American, and the city's population is only 29% African American. We're seeing other trends in Michigan and Louisiana that also show that African Americans are disproportionately part of the death rates in those states. What's behind these numbers, and what can be done to better protect the people most at risk?
Well, look, these numbers are shocking, to be sure, but they're not entirely surprising. And the reason is we've been talking about the health disparities in our city really for years. When you see that African Americans disproportionately have high rates of diabetes, heart disease, and a range of respiratory problems, this disease attacks those underlying medical conditions with a vengeance. So given that disparity in health conditions and life expectancy, we are doing everything that we can to do two things. Number one, make sure that we have good data so we can really effectively measure the impact of this disease. We put these numbers out knowing that still 25% of the providers are not reporting demographic information. So we put in place an order yesterday that requires that reporting. The other thing that we're doing is we've mobilized what we're calling a racial equity rapid response team. We have a model in one area of our city that has really broken down a lot of barriers to getting African Americans access to health care, demystifying the system, and really bringing them into preventative care. We're going to take that model, and then we're going to implement that in a hyper-local way, but all over the city. We're focused on the areas where we're seeing the highest percentage mm-hmm. of death, but then we'll expand it out from there. This is a call to action. Mm-hmm. And when I first saw these numbers, I have to tell you, it took my breath away. But I resolved that we had to do something to make sure that we weren't just bringing people bad news. We were giving them tools to help themselves.
Social distancing for some is a privilege. African Americans yes. are more likely in your city and in cities across the country to have to take public transportation. They're also more likely to hold jobs that you can't do from home. What should be done to make sure that people aren't putting their lives at risk because they have to go to work?
Well, a couple of things, and you're 100% right. In many of our African-American households, they don't have three, four floors where they can separate themselves. So what we're saying is, if you've got somebody in your house that's got an underlying medical condition and or is a senior, make sure that they are segregated out from someone else in a bedroom or someplace else where they can, in effect, quarantine in place. To have a plan for who is going to be going out, whether you have to work or if that same person should be the person that goes out to get groceries and other essential supplies. The other thing that we've done on the south side and the west side is making sure that we're putting more buses with double carriages, if you will, so that we can avoid the crowding on public transportation. And then again, it's all about education and connecting people up to healthcare, emphasizing, making sure that you're washing your hands on a regular basis and using other kinds of product to sanitize your hands and making sure that if you're sick, mm-hmm. you are going to see a doctor. So those are the kind of mm-hmm. strategies that we're going to be employing and making sure that, for example, grocery stores and liquor stores where we tend to congregate, mm-hmm. that those vendors are exercising social distance and how they're allowing customers to move in and out of their facilities. We're going to be much more aggressively inspecting and citing if necessary.
African Americans and people of color also make up a lot of the healthcare workers that are on the front yes. lines of this battle against the coronavirus. When you look at the lack of personal protective equipment and tests, how is that impacting the people that are doing those jobs, especially African Americans and people of color?
Well, what I can say is here in Chicago, one of our top priorities has been making sure that we keep our healthcare system strong and vibrant to be able to meet the surge and the challenge that we have. And that includes making sure that our healthcare workers are protected. So we've done a number of things to help them, but we've shipped out literally millions of pieces of PPE equipment, shields, gowns, gloves, the works, to make sure that our healthcare workers need the equipment, have the equipment that they need to keep themselves safe. In addition to that, we've stood up two hotels just for healthcare workers to give them respite. We know that many of our healthcare workers travel great distances to the hospitals and clinics in which they work. We wanted to give them an opportunity to get respite without having to go all the way back home or worrying about whether or not they were taking the infection to their households. So that's another support that we've given our healthcare workers here in Chicago.
The chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, she held a call today with reporters, and she said that this is an emergency and that data is needed. She called for the CDC and other federal agencies to start collecting and sharing data as it relates to racial breakdowns for the coronavirus. Where do you stand on the lack of data and the need for data when it comes to the coronavirus?
Well, the data is absolutely essential. And one of the things that we ordered yesterday was to make sure that all providers that are doing testing and that are treating patients aren't skipping adding in the demographic information that's so critical for us to be able to measure the impact on a race and ethnicity basis across our city. So we've got a lot of reporting that's happening, but we need to make sure that we fill in that 25% that we've been missing in terms of demographic information. But I agree with you that the data is critically important. It's up on our website, chicago.gov/coronavirus. That information is updated and has been on a daily basis, but we're going to be breaking out the demographic information, and we started that yesterday.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lori Lightfoot, Mayor of Chicago.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In Wisconsin, voters headed to the polls today following days of confusion. Amna Nawaz has more on the first state to hold a major election with in-person voting in the midst of a stay-at-home order.
Multiple political and legal battles preceded today's contests. The Wisconsin Supreme Court yesterday overturned an executive order by the state's Democratic governor to put off in-person voting until June. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled along ideological lines to cut off an extension for absentee voting. Wisconsin stands in contrast to more than a dozen other states that have delayed their primaries in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. We get two views now. First, from Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to the NewsHour, and thanks for making the time. You made clear how you feel about this in a tweet this morning. You said, quote, "Good morning and welcome to the S show." S stands for a word I cannot say right here. Tell me specifically, what are you worried about the impact of today's elections will be?
Well, I honestly feel that I was sharing the frustration of so many people across our state, people who wanted to exercise their right to vote, the people who requested an absentee ballot and had not gotten one yet, the people who've been standing in line for 2 hours to vote. I believe that I shared their frustrations. This is a day that didn't have to happen. It definitely didn't have to happen in this fashion. Governor Evers issued the order to try to delay this election, to move it until June. And Republicans in the legislature, they decided to put people's health and safety at risk, in jeopardy. And in doing that, they've caused mass hysteria. They've caused chaos. And we see it at the polling locations. You see people are unaware of what to do because they have an absentee ballot that they may not have been able to return yet. They've been told that if you don't get the absentee ballot, or if you haven't received one already, even though you've requested one, that you are expected to show up and vote in person. Now, that compromises a person's health because we know that coronavirus is run rampant. Here in this state, we have over 2,500 positive test results. We're now up to 92 deaths in our state. People don't want to take that risk. And what it does is it disenfranchises voters. It makes people not want to get up out of the house and go risk it.
Let me ask you, Lieutenant Governor, about that confusion, though, because there's been criticism of Governor Evers, too. You've had cases, coronavirus cases in Wisconsin for several weeks. He didn't move to change anything about the election until just a few days ago. If public health is really the primary concern, why not change something sooner? Why not act earlier?
I mean, the governor, even before yesterday, called on the legislature to act on the election. He also moved to make sure or to make it possible for people to return their absentee ballots to April 13th, almost a week after today. And many people operated under that assumption. And it's a shame and it's unfortunate that Republicans in the legislature decided that they want to roll back those provisions to allow people to get a chance to exercise their right.
I know this is, there's been a greater push by Democrats to also move, especially during the pandemic, to greater mail-in voting means. I want to put to you what Republicans say about that, though. They say overhauling the systems in 50 states is no easy task. It opens up the process to a whole new world of fraud. And they also accuse Democrats of taking advantage of the pandemic to get around what they call election integrity. What do you say to that?
And, you know, the thing when they say it's no easy task, what is easy? We are dealing with a pandemic. Nothing is going to be easy right now. People are changing their entire ways of life. It's not easy for farming communities. It's not easy for urban communities. It's not easy for sick and elderly populations. It's not easy for a whole lot of people. But it is up to us as government to be able to respond appropriately. And that means we have to take on the tough tasks. You shouldn't seek elected office if you aren't ready to take on the tough task. And if creating a process, a system that would allow for more access to voting, more access to democracy is something that overwhelms you, then you probably shouldn't be in office or decision-making capacity.
Lieutenant Governor, I should ask, the election, of course, is not just about a Democratic presidential primary. There are a lot of state and local offices at stake today. People say, isn't it important to get those roles filled because we're in a pandemic? You need officials in those spots right now.
you know, in the event that the election was delayed as it should have been, I don't think that is too much of an inconvenience to have those people in office for another month or two, given the circumstances, given the fact that we are dealing with a pandemic. Like I said, this is not easy for anybody. We have to make certain adjustments. And I think that that is one that people would be able to agree upon.
That's Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes with us today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And for a different take, I'm joined by Ronna McDaniel, chair of the Republican National Committee. Ms. McDaniel, welcome back to the NewsHour. I want to start by asking you to speak directly to folks in Wisconsin. What do you say to the voters who feel like they have to make a choice today between protecting their health and exercising their right to vote?
Well, the RNC hasn't engaged in states that are changing their elections, and that's up to your governor and your state legislature. Where we intervened in Wisconsin specifically is when the DNC came in and tried to remove safeguards to the integrity of the election, like ID requirements or extending the election an additional 6 days and keeping it open for 6 days. So that's when we intervened, but we haven't done that in any other state as they've moved their elections. That's really up to the local state government.
To be clear, it was Republicans on the ground who were pushing back against the efforts to move the election, understanding that Governor Evers' efforts came late, just a few days before the actual election. Should they have allowed the election to go forward today?
That's a state issue. The RNC only got involved when the DNC filed a lawsuit to remove those safeguards, and that's why we've been engaged in Wisconsin. But the legislature and the governor needed to come together and work on that. And I think the governor is the leader of the state. Should have acted sooner and started doing all these 11th hour proposals to try and change the election. And I think it's a failure of leadership on his part that he didn't move sooner.
Let me ask you from the voters' perspective, and there's clearly an access issue. There were a number of polling places that had to be closed because of coronavirus concerns. Do you believe that everyone in Wisconsin who was eligible to vote got their chance or will get their chance to do so today?
So Wisconsin still had early voting, and they still had the opportunity to receive those absentee ballots. None of that was prevented through this process. What we felt uncomfortable with is an election being open for 7 additional days when you had an election day of April 7th. So anyone who postmarks their ballot by today at 8 p.m., their vote will count. And that is the right way. We want everyone to be able to vote. We just want to make sure there are safeguards that make sure that people who shouldn't be voting don't vote.
There are concerns about the absentee ballots, though. There were a number of people, thousands of people, in fact, who requested them who still hadn't received them as of this morning. With all the confusion around that process, do you really believe that everyone there who wants to vote will get a chance to do so today?
Well, they're going to have to look to their state government because the governor and the legislature was pushing for April 7th. And if they didn't get that process done, that's going to be up to the state to make sure that they got those ballots out. Of course, we want everyone to be able to vote. What we did not want is to see safeguards taken away, like ID, making sure that the voter who is turning in the ballot is the voter whose name is on the ballot. Those types of things that safeguard the integrity of the election. With so much uncertainty right now in our country, we need people to have confidence in our election process. And that's why the RNC got involved and pushed for these ID requirements, the witnesses for absentee ballots, and also not keeping an election open 6 additional days beyond the election date.
While there is a global pandemic, while the virus still is of cases arising here in the United States, do you believe any state should be holding in-person voting?
You know, that's going to be up to the state governors to decide. You haven't seen the national parties get involved in that. That's up to the states and the legislatures based on what's happening with their population. What I will say, though, is you've seen at the national level, Democrats try and push election agendas like ballot harvesting, which certainly isn't safe when you're going door to door to collect ballots, or things like getting rid of absentee witness ID requirements. So those are things that we're going to push back on. We do not want to dismantle the things that keep our election integrity in place. And that's where the RNC is getting involved. The states can determine when they hold those elections. That's why the states and the governors and the legislatures have that role.
That is Ronna McDaniel, chair of the Republican National Committee, joining us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And a news update before we go tonight. President Trump said this evening that he is considering ending United States funding for the World Health Organization. He told reporters that the International Health Group, quote, missed the call on the danger of a coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. contributes more money to the WHO than any other nation. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Stay safe, please. And we'll see you soon.